What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting a proposal on North Korea. The United States submitted to the UN Security Council Thursday a draft resolution calling for new sanctions on North Korea for its recent nuclear test and long-range missile launch. Here is U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power.
The United States tabled a draft UN Security Council resolution that, if adopted, would break new ground and represent the strongest set of sanctions imposed by the Security Council in more than two decades.
Samantha Power. U.S. President Barack Obama met Thursday with his top security officials to discuss U.S. efforts to combat the Islamic State group. The meeting included senior officials from the White House, State Department, Intelligence Community, Defense Department, and Treasury Department. Mr. Obama briefed reporters.
The fight against ISIL will remain difficult, but we will continue to draw on all elements of our national power: military, intelligence, diplomacy, homeland security, law enforcement, and the strength of our communities. And I am confident that we will prevail.
The meetings were the latest in a series of updates on the U.S. campaign to counter the Islamic State group. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made a stop in South Sudan Thursday to push the government and rebel forces to implement last year's peace accord.
The parties must know that responsibility does not end with the signing of an agreement. In many ways, it begins with the signing of agreement.
Mr. Ban's visit to Juba came as the two sides prepare to form a unity government. President Salva Kiir will remain in office while rebel chief Riek Machar will serve as first vice president. This is VOA News. Top intelligence officials are asking whether Russia is really committed to a peaceful solution in Syria. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper told lawmakers Thursday Russia may be considering putting more troops on the ground in Syria in order to bolster the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. Clapper spoke to the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Intelligence officials, though, are saying they have not seen indications of any major uptick in Russian operations ahead of the midnight Saturday deadline for a cessation of hostilities in Syria. The European Union's migration commissioner warned Thursday the bloc's migration system risks a complete breakdown. Lisa Bryant has more.
Greece recalled its ambassador to Austria after Vienna hosted a meeting with Balkan states on Wednesday that Greek officials were not invited to. Those attending, including non-EU members, agreed to a series of unilateral restrictions to reduce the asylum seekers crossing their borders. But that leaves Greece, often the first point of entry, with a mounting migrant problem. Athens has threatened to block future EU migrant decisions if member states don't accept mandatory quotas. Lisa Bryant, Paris.
FBI Director James Comey told a congressional committee on Thursday the government's current dispute with Apple is the most difficult question he has seen in government.
The San Bernardino litigation is not about us trying to send a message or establish some precedent. It really isn't. It's about trying to be competent in investigating something that is an active investigation.
Officials want Apple to help them unlock an iPhone used by the shooters in last year's terrorist attack in San Bernardino, California. Apple has refused. Apple CEO Tim Cook told ABC News Wednesday he believes the government is demanding his company produce software that could undermine the security of hundreds of millions of its customers. He said doing so would also trample fundamental civil liberties. Apple filed a motion in court asking a federal magistrate to reverse her order that the company help the FBI hack into the phone. Businessman Donald Trump has taken center stage at a Republican debate in Texas. It's going on right now. Florida Senator Marco Rubio and Texas Senator Ted Cruz are trying to curb the electoral momentum of the front runner. Two other candidates, Ohio Governor John Kasich and former neurosurgeon Ben Carson, remain in the race and are on the debate stage. Somalia's president said Wednesday that between 180 and 200 Kenyan soldiers were killed when Islamist militants attacked an African Union base in southwestern Somalia last month. President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed made the disclosure in an interview on Somali TV, but a Kenyan Defense Forces spokesman quickly denied Mohamed's figures. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Bate in Washington. Today's Friday, February 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan rebel leader promises a return to Juba next month.
I'm ready to go to Juba, particularly at this time when the JMAC has confirmed and assured me that Juba is being demilitarized and that our forces shall be transported to Juba.
Riek Machar is South Sudan's rebel leader. Zimbabweans are divided over tomorrow's lavish birthday party for President Robert Mugabe. We'll tell you about a new movie about a Senegalese young man who tries to immigrate to Europe and a strong message for African leaders currently visiting Burundi.
I think unless we see very rapid progress towards dialogue, now's the time to look at the people who are most responsible for blocking dialogue and most responsible for violence and implement travel ban and asset freezes on those individuals.
Richard Moncrief is the Central Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group, and the European Union is told it has just days to make progress on the migrant crisis. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar has assured United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon in a telephone conversation that he is ready to return to the capital Juba in March to take up his position as first vice president in a national unity government. In an interview with VOA, Machar said he is only waiting for the first phase of the security arrangement as agreed to in a peace accord to be implemented before he returns. Machar tells reporter Peter Clarty that Secretary General Ban Ki-moon promised support for the full implementation of the accord that he signed with President Salva Kiir.
The Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, he actually wanted to know when I would be going to Juba. What I have told him is that I am ready to go to Juba, particularly at this time when the JMAC has confirmed and assured me that Juba is being demilitarized and that our forces, a minimum force of 1,370, shall be transported to Juba. So I have assured him I'm ready to go to Juba. I'm just waiting for the first phase of the security arrangements being put in place.
Following all these meetings with heads of state, have you had a chance of talking to President Salva Kiir in terms of the formation of the unity transitional government that both of you signed the agreement to implement?
Now, this is an issue that cannot be discussed over the phone. I will have to be in Juba, at least once I'm in Juba, and I do consultation with my colleagues and also with the rest of South Sudanese who are interested in the formation of government. Then we'll form it. You can't discuss it on phone.
What is the next step forward? Since now it's tentatively agreed that you will return to Juba, what is the next step forward once you get there?
Once I get to Juba, once we form the government, then we should start discussing. I hope by then President Salva would have suspended the 28 states. Then we would discuss, as is stated in the roadmap, the communique of the IGAD Council of Ministers. Then we will discuss the number of states. I hope we will reach to an agreement because I'm also interested in increment of the states. You see, in a scientific manner, we should discuss and agree. So, but if we fail, we have no choice. We will return to the 10 states. This is one activity, but the major activity would be assuring people of South Sudan that peace has come, and which would mean stability, political stability, and security is maintained. And then now we can address issues such as the IDPs, which are in the UNMISS protection centers.
Riek Machar is South Sudan's rebel leader and first vice president in a soon-to-be-formed unity government. He spoke with reporter Peter Clarty from Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. A delegation of five African leaders continues its visit to Burundi today, Friday, in an effort to push parties to the Burundian conflict toward a dialogue. The delegation, led by South African President Jacob Zuma, was expected to meet with government, opposition, and civil society leaders. Their trip comes on the heels of a visit to Burundi this week by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon as part of an overall international effort to end the country's 10-month-old conflict. Richard Moncrief is the Central Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. He says his organization has urged the AU delegation to deliver tough messages to both President Pierre Nkurunziza and Burundi's armed opposition, including a call for credible dialogue outside Burundi and an end to impunity and ongoing killings.
The government has initiated a national dialogue, but we have to remember that before doing so, it drove the vast majority of serious opposition into exile by threatening them and threatening their families. And there's lots of evidence that shows that. And having driven them all into exile, they started a dialogue with the people left. That's not acceptable, and that's not going to solve the problems the country has. So our view is that the dialogue does have to happen outside the country, and security guarantees need to be offered to all sides in order to take part properly in that dialogue and with some confidence and good faith.
The government has said that it does not want to negotiate with certain members of the opposition because it considers them as, quote, terrorists because they have taken up arms. What do you say to that?
Well, we don't know exactly who's taken up arms. There's been attacks that have not been claimed. Most of the political opposition, including CNARED, the main opposition organisation, do not advocate violence, so they should be talked to. And we shouldn't forget that there's been an awful lot of violence against civilians by government agents. So the best thing is to get around and talk with the widest possible range of people.
There's been this talk of sanctions against the Burundian government. And in fact, the European Union has imposed sanctions. So what about the African Union? What can the African Union do to put more pressure on the stakeholders, including the Burundian government?
The African Union was set up for cases like this, for cases like Burundi, when it was founded in 2000. Preventative diplomacy to prevent violence in African countries was at the forefront of the mind of the people who wrote the African Union Constitution. One of the tools that the African Union potentially has to enact preventative diplomacy is sanctions. The African Union Commission itself talked of the need for sanctions on Burundian actors last year, but they haven't implemented them. I think unless we see very rapid progress towards dialogue, now's the time to look at the people who are most responsible for blocking dialogue and most responsible for violence and implement travel bans and asset freezes on those individuals.
As I was reading the statement by your organization, I saw something that I would probably call a radical suggestion. You're suggesting perhaps that the African Union consider, for example, removing Burundian peacekeepers around Africa. Why do you make that?
Well, I don't think it's all that radical. We feel that it's important now to have a look at Burundian troops in peacekeeping operations around Africa. We know that the informal militia in Burundi, who are responsible for a lot of abuses, are being given places in the police and now in the army. With one third of Burundian troops on peacekeeping deployment, it seems a great risk that some of these individuals will end up in peacekeeping operations. That seems both unacceptable and indeed unsustainable. So the United Nations and the African Union should start now to look at ways of replacing those Burundian troops gradually, carefully, and with a due regard to the risk that that might bring, whether in Somalia or indeed in Burundi. But we feel that that's work that needs to start now, unless there is rapid progress made towards negotiations in Burundi.
Richard Moncrief is the Central Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group. He was speaking with me from London, United Kingdom. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, February 26th. And still to come, Mark Ouma's Pulse and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Zimbabweans are divided over President Robert Mugabe's lavish birthday party to be held tomorrow Saturday in Masvingo province. Supporters of the ruling ZANU-PF party said this is the right time to pay tribute to the 92-year-old Zimbabwean leader who they say played a key role in liberating the country from the yoke of colonialism. but opponents say there is no reason for the celebration as Zimbabwe is currently facing serious food shortages due to a devastating drought fueled by the El Nino weather phenomena. For a perspective, reporter Gabe Dube of VOA Zimbabwe program reached ZANU-PF legislator Joseph Shuma and George Umkwanazi of the People's Democratic Party, led by former Finance Minister Tendai Biti.
To start with, it is a waste of time in Zimbabwe. It is a waste of money to use such kind of resources to pamper an old man of 92. In a country where the citizens are starving. You know, the Southern Africa is faced with a very serious drought, and you have a president who purports to care for his people, you know, allowing himself to be pampered at the cost of $1 million or so in a mere birthday. I believe that is a scandal, and it should not be allowed to happen.
Mr. Chuba?
I think Mr. Mkwanazi probably is talking from a very ill-informed position. For starters, you must know that the president has done everything to make sure that this hunger issue is averted. He has declared a state of emergency towards this hunger issue, and the resources have been mobilized. As I speak, grain is being purchased from countries with that grain. And besides, the money that is being used for the birthday bash is not coming from any of the public coffers. It is money coming from private individuals who accept the cause of the 21st February movement, because it's not just about celebrating the president's 92 years on this earth. It's also about the youth themselves. So it's a different pace altogether. It's a different budget altogether. But definitely the president is out there making sure that the hunger crisis, the hunger issues are actually held and managed in a proper manner.
And of course, Mr. Mkwanazi, I think Mr. Chuma is being truthful in saying that the money that is being used is sourced from individuals. So at the end of the day, there are no state resources that are being used here. Is that the case?
Actually, that's a height of insanity to say that the money is sourced from individuals. You know that in Zimbabwe, politics and economy are closely linked. The people who are purported to be providing these kind of monies, these are the people who have been at the helm of destroying the country. I mean, to say that there is value in the 21st February movement, I mean, to lose it totally. Because here is a man who has nothing to offer, a man who has nothing to teach anyone in terms of leadership, a man who has presided over a country's crumbling economy to a point where the country is unable to face a drought situation. We are where we are because the ZANU-PF government, which is led by Robert Mugabe, killed the economy through the fast-track land reform program.
That was George Mkwanazi of the People's Democratic Party of Zimbabwe. You also heard from Joseph Shuma, a ZANU-PF legislator. Both were speaking with reporter Gabe Dube of VOA Zimbabwe program. Sega is a new film recently shot in Senegal about a young man who tries to immigrate to Europe, but he finds himself in detention and then gets deported back to his hometown of Dakar. In addition to not achieving his dream of migration to Europe, the young man also loses his good friend along the way. The film just wrapped up shooting and will most likely be released at the end of this year or early next year. Producer and director Adil Ibrahim talks to Ricky Stryak about why she chose this particular story and how filming in Dakar with a mostly Senegalese cast and crew bodes well for the country's film scene.
After being in Dakar and Senegal and hearing about stories, you know, a few years ago of young men, particularly who were taking the pirogues and ending up kind of in the Canary Islands and other, this is before the overland route became more popular. Or also seen films and heard stories about what happens when some of these people make it, quote unquote, to Europe. I was curious about what happens when someone doesn't make it and ends up kind of back. And that's where the film Sega started. I wanted to explore how someone would feel after going through all of that and not making it.
What kind of research did you do before this film? I'm a researcher at heart. I research not only through international organizations and their reports on migration, but I also did, you know, personal interviews with immigrants that had made it to Europe. So, for example, when I was in France, I talked to various Senegalese migrants there, as well as in Morocco, and sometimes Italy, to find out about their journey. And also through the process of making the film, some of our cast have relationships with people who've also taken these journeys and either made it or came back as well.
Another thing that's cool about Sega is you filmed in Senegal. You used, as far as I understand, an all Senegalese cast almost. A lot of your production team was also based in Dakar or Senegalese. How did you find it shooting local? Because I feel like I hear more and more actually about filmmakers, you know, using Senegal as a place to film. And not only that, but using Senegalese actors, Senegalese people behind the scenes as well, sound producers, etc. What do you think about Senegal as a film location?
It was very important for me to make sure that the cast and crew were reflective of the country and the place and the story that, you know, we were trying to make. So I didn't want to have a ton of expats working on the project. I'm all for intercultural production, but for me it was important to have a predominantly Senegalese cast and crew. But one, because it's very much a Senegalese story, it's also very much an African story. The only kind of foreigners on our team were me and my cinematographer, Dylan Varekia. We also have a New York-based producer, but everyone else was Senegalese, and it was wonderful because our collaboration and drive, you know, to make sure that it was an authentic story and true to life kind of was infused in every aspect of the production. And I kind of joke that it's like the film that the village made, because all of us were so committed and passionate about the project that I hope that that only kind of shows up in the final product as well. But it was wonderful. It was a wonderful creative collaborative process. We just had open dialogue and everyone felt free to contribute or have lent, you know, input. And we were in people's homes and in the markets and in, you know, on the streets. And I just felt that the project was not only embraced, you know, by the cast and crew, but by everyone that we kind of came across.
Adele Ibrahim is the director and producer of the film Sega. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar. The European Union's Migration Commissioner warned on Thursday that the organization's migration system risks a complete breakdown, underscoring the deepening EU divisions over the issue. Greece has recalled its ambassador to Austria after not being invited to a migrant meeting. Lisa Bryant has more for VOA from Paris.
Speaking after migration talks in Brussels, European Commissioner Dimitris Avramopoulos warned EU member states have just over a week to make progress on the migrant standoff before a summit with Turkey on March 7th.
In the next 10 days, we need tangible and clear results on the ground. Otherwise, there is a danger, there is a risk that the whole system will completely break down.
The meeting aimed to heal deepening divisions among EU member states over handling the migrant influx. Greece recalled its ambassador to Austria after Vienna hosted a meeting with Balkan states on Wednesday that Greek officials were not invited to. Those attending, including non-EU members, agreed to a series of unilateral restrictions to reduce the asylum seekers crossing their borders. But that leaves Greece, often the first point of entry, with a mounting migrant problem. Athens has threatened to block future EU migrant decisions if member states don't accept mandatory quotas. Speaking on the sidelines of the Brussels meeting, UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says many asylum seekers arriving in Greece are refugees rather than economic migrants.
We have discussed with the government of Greece how to handle a potential increase of refugees that have to stay in Greece because they cannot go any further. But that will require a lot of work and a lot of additional resources.
Our viewers, Lisa Bryant reporting. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Margot Woman, Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on football. The Confederation of African Football First Vice President Suketu Patel and the Asia Football Confederation Vice President Praful Patel reaffirmed the two continental bodies' support for Bahrain's Sheikh Salman Al Khalifa in the FIFA presidential elections in Zurich, Switzerland, today, Friday. The two confederations, who account for 100 out of the 209 national affiliates of FIFA, held separate meetings in Zurich, Switzerland, to fine-tune their position ahead of the vote. Staying in Zurich, the Confederation of African Football and Asia Football Confederation impressed upon their collective 100-strong members to back the reform package which will be put to the vote at the FIFA Extraordinary Congress today, Friday. The reform package includes a maximum of 3 4-year term limits for the FIFA President, FIFA Council membership, Audit and Compliance Committee, and judicial bodies. Other reforms proposals include separation of political and management functions, promotion of women in decision-making environment, appointing independent committee members, enhanced committee efficiency, stringent integrity check, and greater transparency through stakeholder representation. Meanwhile, the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Castle Cup is rescheduled from May to June. The tournament organizing committee chairman Timothy Shongwe told the media in Johannesburg, South Africa. Shongwe says the change was aimed at accommodating the 2017 Orange Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. The 14 members of COSAFA are Angola, Botswana, Comoro Islands, Lesotho, Madagascar, Malawi, Mauritius, Mozambique, Namibia, Seychelles, South Africa, Swaziland, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The two-week contest starts on the 11th of June and will be hosted by the defending champions and Namibia. Finally, Egypt hosts Burkina Faso in a friendly match in Borg El Arabi Stadium in Alexandria tomorrow, Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a very good weekend. We see you again on Monday morning.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 26th. On this day in 1928, rhythm and blues singer Antoine Fats Domino was born in New Orleans, Louisiana. Domino's first million-selling record, The Fat Man, was released in 1949. He went on to record 23 gold singles. Blueberry Hill was his most famous recording. Also on this day in 1869, the 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution was sent to all the states to ratify. It gave blacks the right to vote. On this day in 1964, boxer Cassius Clay changed his name to Muhammad Ali after he accepted the Islam religion and rejected Christianity. Also on this day in 1926, Theodore Tiger Flowers became the first black boxer to capture the World Middleweight Boxing Championship when he defeated Harry Greb. Flowers was the first African-American after Jack Johnson to challenge for a world title. He helped to reform the image of the black prize fighters with his ability to garner broad support among both whites and blacks. On this day in 1926, Dr. Carter G. Woodson started the Negro History Week. Later in 1976, it was changed to Black History Month. Also on this day in 1962, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that forced separation of blacks and whites on buses and trains violated the U.S. Constitution. Did you know that Booker T. Washington, a former slave, was the founder of the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama? Its purpose was to help educate black people so that they could find decent jobs. On this day in African history in 1908, King Leopold II was paid £5 million in exchange for the Congo Free State, later renamed the Belgian Congo. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 26th. Congratulations to Moses Gwari of Jimeta in Adamawa State, Nigeria, and Martina Titi Ayuba of Nasarawa Egon in Nasarawa State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 25th question. Which 19th century African-American inventor is known as the Black Thomas Edison? The answer, Granville T. Woods. Now, here is our question for today, February 26th. Who did Mike Tyson beat in 1989 to become the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world? Once again, who did Mike Tyson beat in 1989 to become the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Friday, February 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte in Washington. Have a lovely day, Africa.
Next on Let's Talk. School uniforms. Do you support a school dress code? Join host Sande Shomari and his guests discussing school uniforms. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.